Emerge Publishing presents The Christmas Feather, written by Eileen Enright Hodgetts and recorded by the author. For my brother. Between September 1939 and December 1944, more than 2.5 million British children were evacuated to foster homes in the countryside and to Australia, America, and Canada. Dorset, England, December 23rd, 1940. He's a pirate! I looked at my brother in horror. It was bad enough that we'd been sent away from home to live in this wild, unfamiliar place, and now it appeared that we were going to be living with a pirate. My mother apparently intended to leave me with this man. My mother, who would not allow me, a girl of 7, to cross the road without gripping her hand, intended to abandon me in the home of a stranger. And not just any stranger, a pirate. My mother leaned down and hissed to my brother, "Stop it this minute, Peter. Don't tease your sister. I'm expecting you to be a responsible brother and to take care of her." Peter grinned. Later in life, girls would tell me that they fell in love with Peter on account of his grin. I personally thought the grin was the worst part of him. To me, that grin meant just wait until Mummy's gone and see what happens. There was absolutely no possibility that Peter would be a responsible brother. My mother looked at her watch. "I'll have to go soon," she said. "Where has your uncle gone?" The uncle in question, a grey-bearded man who was actually my great-uncle on my father's side and a complete stranger, had disappeared down a dark hallway and left us all alone. There we stood, in our uncle's antiquated kitchen, with our pathetic little suitcases and our government-issued gas masks, and the man who was supposed to care for us until the bombs stopped dropping on London was not even around to say goodbye to our mother.
"Pieces of 8!"
I spun around in horror. As if things were not bad enough, with my brother teasing and my mother leaving, my uncle's parrot, a mangy, green creature, now proved himself to be a character straight out of Treasure Island. He was sitting on the mantel shelf amid a disconcerting collection of items. Disconcerting because all or any of them could have belonged to a pirate. In the dim light of the single window I could see a spyglass, an oil lamp, so no electricity, and a small brass-bound chest that could have contained the aforementioned pieces of 8. Granted, it was not a big chest for a pirate, and 15 men would have had a lot of trouble dancing on it, but it did look very piratical. My mother looked at Peter and pointed down the corridor. "Go and find him." Peter's grin faded. "I don't know where he is." Mummy pointed again. "He's down there somewhere. Go and see what you can find. Tell him I have to leave." I must admit that I admired my brother's courage. He was only 9, and we were in the dark and gloomy home of a total stranger, who was most probably a pirate, but he squared his shoulders and disappeared into the gloom. My mother pulled out a handkerchief and wiped her eyes. I comforted her the best way I knew how, by breaking into heart-rending sobs and clinging to her knees. When she finally managed to pull free of my desperate grasp, she sank down into one of the battered old chairs set by the fireplace and pulled me onto her lap. I know, I was 7 years old and far too big for lap-sitting, but I was in desperate need of comfort. My father was hidden away somewhere doing war work, so secret that he was not allowed to come home in case he would let anything slip. My home was being bombed every night, my school was closed, and now we were being sent into the country to live with someone called Uncle Art. Well, you get the idea. My point is that I was at that moment not too big to want to sit on my mother's lap. My brother reappeared with Uncle Art in tow. The parrot lifted off from the mantelshelf and settled on Uncle Art's shoulder. My mother tucked her handkerchief into her pocket and gave him a half-hearted smile. "I'm sorry about this," she said. "There's really no one else. All of my family are in London, and Jim said you were the only one of his family he could think of, and I didn't know about your wife." What wife? Jim said you had a wife, and as she's not here, I assumed... Her voice petered out. I was an adult with children of my own before I realized that my mother suffered from what we would now call social anxiety. She was so very often afraid that she would say the wrong thing that mainly she said nothing. I suppose that on this occasion what she was trying not to say was that she didn't realize that Uncle Art's wife had died or run off with the postman or entered a lunatic asylum. I'm sure all those thoughts were rushing around in her awkward, anxious brain, but she couldn't give voice to any of them. I didn't realize, she said again. Jim said, Ah, I can't say that I've ever met your Jim, Uncle Art said. Can't place him. I have a girt many brothers, and they all had a girt many children. I suppose he's one of them. He shrugged, and the parrot uttered a complaining squawk, and I came to the conclusion that a girt many was pirate speak for a great many. For a moment, Uncle Art looked a little sad. I've not seen my brothers these many years, he said. I've been away at sea. I drew in a sharp breath. Peter's suspicions were confirmed. Uncle Art had been away at sea, and that could only mean one thing. He could say he was a sailor until his face turned blue, but we knew the truth. He wasn't a sailor. He was a pirate. If it was obvious to me, a little girl who had never even seen the sea, why couldn't my mother see it? If she knew he was a pirate, she wouldn't leave us. I tugged at her hand. Please, Mummy, let me come home. Peter can stay, but I have to come home. My mother pursed her lips. I can't, Ellie. I really can't. It's no good asking again. She stretched her lips into an encouraging smile. It won't be for long, dear. Daddy is working very hard, and he says he'll have Hitler on the run in no time at all. My father was a very efficient man, and I was surprised that he hadn't already put a stop to the bombing, which had started in September and spoiled everything about my life. We hadn't seen him in months, but my mother said that he had sent a message to say that we were not to go to strangers, like the other children from our school. We were lucky enough to have relatives outside of London, and so we would be taken to someone called Uncle Art, who lived deep in the Dorset countryside. I was told to be a brave girl, and Peter was told to be a good brother. As Peter and I did nothing but squabble, I could not imagine any circumstance under which he would be a good brother, and I wondered if my father had forgotten how very horrible Peter could be. As I considered our surroundings, I could only see one bright spot in the whole scenario. This was a place that even Hitler wouldn't bother to bomb, so I wouldn't need to drag my gas mask around with me wherever I went. Perhaps I wouldn't even have to take it to school the way I did in London. "Come outside with me," my mother said. "Let's say goodbye outside." She hustled me out the door. Peter followed, but she shooed him away. "I have to talk to Ellie," she said. We stepped out into the muddy front garden. The watery sunlight was turning the rushes of the raggedy thatched roof into shafts of gold, and seagulls soared above us in a clear blue sky. We both looked up, out of habit, searching for the distant glint of sunlight on airplane wings. Ours or theirs? We never knew. Here, so far from London, the sky was clear. Tonight the bombs would fall in London, but Peter and I would not be there. Our mother should be home by dark and ready to take up her place on the fire watch. Without us to care for, she could make a meaningful contribution to the war effort. I knew all these things to be true, yet I could feel nothing but resentment. My mother had said this place would be beautiful, a country cottage where I could sleep in a little room under the eaves, and Auntie Gladys would fatten us up with rabbit pies and fresh churned butter. We were both looking pale, she said. We should not be in London. Ellie, my mother said, sinking to her knees, I'm afraid I was wrong about Auntie Gladys. It seems that Uncle Art doesn't have a sister or a wife or whatever we thought he had. Now, this is all right for Peter because he's a boy, but it's not the same for you. You will have to do some things for yourself because it wouldn't be right for Uncle Art to do them. Like what? I asked. Taking a bath by yourself. Wash your own hair. I had never washed my own hair. Never even tried. My mother said I was too clumsy and I would get soap in my eyes. She had never elaborated on the possible result of getting soap in my eyes, but I always assumed it would result in instant, maybe permanent, blindness. Now she was telling me that it was all up to me. What if I went blind? Would that make her take me home? What about Peter? I asked. He's a boy, my mother said. It's not the same. What about Christmas? I asked. My mother's sad goodbye face shifted into panic. It's not Christmas yet. It is, I insisted. It's 2 days away. Have you told Father Christmas where we are? My mother rose from her knees and looked up into the sky. Father Christmas, she repeated vaguely. Yes. How is he going to find us? I looked back at Uncle Art's squalid cottage. It did at least have a chimney, so that was one problem solved. My mother's voice was suddenly firm. Father Christmas is not coming this year, not with all the bombs. It would be too dangerous. Christmas is postponed. This announcement rendered me speechless, and my mother took the opportunity to kiss me on the top of my head and hurry away as fast as she could, stumbling on her pre-war high heels along the road that was little more than a cart track. I watched her until she disappeared from sight around a bend in the lane, and then I went indoors. Uncle Art was nowhere in sight, and Peter was standing in the middle of the dingy old kitchen looking forlorn. The bravado that had kept him going in the face of the horrible old cottage, the mangy parrot, and our mother's departure had suddenly disappeared. He swiped the back of his hand across his eyes. "He has a wooden leg," he said. "No, he doesn't. He limps." "That doesn't mean he has a wooden leg," I said. "He could just have sprained his ankle or something." Peter shook his head. "It's a wooden leg, I know it. While you were outside with Mummy, the parrot said it again."
"Said what?"
"Pieces of eight. It's just like Treasure Island. Do you know that this isn't just a cottage? It's a pub, just like in the book. In the book, Jim lives in an inn." "Oh, you're just trying to scare me," I said. "This isn't a pub. It's just a mangy old cottage."
"It's not like the pubs in London," Peter agreed, "but it's a pub. There's a room down the end of the corridor, and it has a bar, and there are men in there drinking."
He sat down in the chair by the empty fireplace and lowered his head into his hand. "I expect I'll be press ganged and taken to sea like Jim." I looked at him.
"Jim, in Treasure Island."
"I know what you mean," I snapped. Peter and I were not in the habit of comforting each other. We basically led separate lives. He was allowed to run up and down the street with his friends and to take the bus to the boys' primary school. I was not allowed out without my mother, and she walked me to the girls' school every day. In the rare moments that our lives intersected, Peter teased me mercilessly, and I responded with tears and tantrums.
"There's no bathroom," Peter said. I looked.
"What do you mean, no bathroom?"
"No bathroom and no toilet."
These words triggered an overwhelming need to relieve myself. We'd been on the train for hours coming down here from London. Because the carriage was filled with troops coming and going from the war, my mother said I should not use the toilet. If I didn't drink anything, she said, I would be fine until we got to Uncle Art's lovely little cottage.
Lovely little cottage? Where did my mother get that idea?
It wasn't a lovely little cottage. It was a squalid little pub with no bathroom. The very absence of a bathroom made my need more urgent. It could not be ignored, and I had to do something. I crossed my legs and looked at Peter.
You should probably go outside, he said.
What do you mean? I'm not a dog.
That's what I'd do, he said.
Well, I'm not you, I replied, crossing and recrossing my legs.
Peter raised his eyebrows at me.
What are you going to do? He asked. Are you going to wait for Mummy to come back?
Well, don't be silly.
Well, at that moment, the parrot flew in from somewhere in the back of the house, followed immediately by the shuffling, limping arrival of Uncle Art. He made a sharp gesture to Peter.
Out of my chair, young fellow.
Peter sprang to his feet.
Black spot, said the parrot.
Daft ramshacklem, said Uncle Art.
Peter hung his head.
Not you, him,
said Uncle Art. As Uncle Art was wagging an arthritic finger at the parrot, I took this to mean that Uncle Art was not calling Peter a daft whatever it was. On the strength of this moment of not quite so dreadfulness, I plucked up my courage.
Where's the toilet?
The natty, Uncle Art queried. Out the back, down the garden path. Take a broom. I stared at him. I was young and inexperienced, and I had never encountered anything in the toilet that required me to take a broom. I also had not ever been required to go out the back and down the garden path to relieve myself.
For the rats, Uncle Art said. They won't hurt ye, and they'll run if ye bang them about a bit.
At that moment, the pressure in my bladder and the fear that I might wet myself forced me into sudden adulthood and independence. I took up the broom and set off down the garden path. I will draw a veil over what happened next. Let me just say that I quickly learned how to use the broom. As a result of holding my breath, I was slightly dizzy as I returned along the path, and I jumped in fright when Peter emerged from among the tangle of tall weeds. He was grinning.
There's no school, he said.
His words made no sense. Of course there was a school. We had been instructed by no less an authority than the Minister of Education himself that we should pack our school uniforms as they would be acceptable to our temporary school authorities. In our suitcases we carried our latest school reports and any notes our teachers cared to pass on to the new teachers. We would go to school, we would make new friends, and we would do all this for the good of our country and so that we didn't have to sleep in the underground station.
Uncle Art says he doesn't know anything about school, Peter said. They haven't had a school in the village since he was a boy.
He held out his hand. Give me the broom, I have to go. I grimaced as I looked at the little shack poking its head above the weeds.
You won't like it, I said.
Peter took the broom.
Did you see any rats?
I nodded.
Big ones?
I shuddered.
Some of them?
Peter paused for a moment and looked at me with unexpected sympathy.
You just have to pretend they're Germans, he said.
He shouldered the broom and marched away, leaving me with a tiny spark of comfort. Perhaps he was not going to be awful. Perhaps he was going to be like the big brothers in the books I had read. I heard a sudden racket of banging and cursing from the general direction of the privy, and moments later Peter exploded into view, visibly shaken. He stopped suddenly and squared his shoulders.
I've taken care of them, he said.
We went back into the kitchen. The sun was already sinking behind the trees, but the kitchen was unexpectedly bright. Because I had seen an oil lamp on the mantelpiece, I had assumed that Uncle Art would not have electricity, because a man who didn't have a toilet surely wouldn't have electric lights. I was wrong. A single, very bright bulb dangled over the kitchen table and illuminated a plate of cheese sandwiches.
"They're for ye," Uncle Art said. "Tomorrow I'll get ye a brace of furry things and make ye a stew."
Peter and I exchanged horrified glances. What exactly were these furry things that were to be stewed for our benefit? The only furry things I'd seen were the rats in the privy. Uncle Art, apparently noticing our concern, added an explanation. After much thought he said,
"Hoppy things with long ears and little tails thump their legs."
"Rabbits," Peter said.
Uncle Art reeled back in horror. "Oh, don't he say that word. That's bad luck. There's no one in the whole of Dorset that will say that word."
"What? Rabbits?" Peter asked.
Uncle Art clenched his fist. "If something happens, it'll be your fault. Them furry things with their digging can bring down the whole cave. I've seen it with my own eyes. Don't you say it no more."
I filed away his words. He had a cave. Who else always had a cave? Pirates. That's who. I took a bite of the cheese sandwich, which actually tasted very good.
"Uncle," I asked, "are we anywhere near the sea?"
"Anywhere near," he said. "You're on top of it, lass. Sea runs into a cave right under this old inn."
"I've never seen the sea," I admitted.
"Oh, you can see it tomorrow," said Uncle Art. "Take a bath if you like." Oh dear, the dreaded bath, the place where I would get soap in my eyes and turn blind.
I don't need a bath.
Well, not yet, Uncle Art said, but you will one day. I go every day. Salt water's good for the rheumaticisms.
The poor child will not be bathing with you in the sea, said a voice from the doorway.
I looked up and saw an enormous woman. She stomped into the kitchen and unwound a scarf that had been holding back a great tangled cloud of grey hair. She had a red nose, three or four chins, legs like tree trunks, and hands like bunches of sausages. I was not allowed to take the Lord's name in vain, but I couldn't help myself. Oh, God, was there no end to the awfulness of this place? This must be Auntie Gladys, the woman who was going to feed us fresh churned butter and rabbit pies. Of course, they wouldn't be called rabbit pies because mentioning rabbits was bad luck and would cause the furry things to go berserk and thump so hard they would bring down the cave that was underneath this house and we would all fall into the sea, which was where Uncle Art wanted me to take a bath. I released my terror in a great and tragic wail. From the corner of my eye, I saw Uncle Art and the enormous woman reel back in horror. The parrot fluttered from Uncle Art's shoulder and onto Peter's head, and blood began to pour down Peter's face. I hoped it was the parrot's claws drawing blood from his scalp, but it was possible that my screaming had burst his eardrums. It was something my mother had often predicted. Something cold and wet pushed against my hand. I looked down, wondering what new terror was about to visit itself upon us, and saw a pair of soulful brown eyes. A dog. A brown and white spaniel-y kind of dog. I aborted the scream that I was about to inflict on the room. A tiny ray of hope made its way into my befuddled, traumatized mind. I had never been allowed to have a dog. Uncle Art had a dog.
That there's Penny, said Uncle Art. Why don't he sit down and give her a pat?
I collapsed onto the floor. Penny laid her head on my lap. I was suddenly aware of someone else sitting beside me. Peter rested his bleeding forehead against my shoulder, and I didn't mind.
Perhaps he's not a pirate, he whispered. Pirates don't have dogs.
The parrot settled on the floor and declared that he was a pretty Polly.
No, you're not, Peter said.
For one brief moment, peace reigned. But I could not restrain myself. I could not just enjoy having the dog's head on my lap and my brother actually leaning on my shoulder.
Father Christmas isn't coming this year, I said. Mummy told me that Hitler won't let him.
Peter sat up.
Only babies believe in Father Christmas, he announced.
The enormous woman was not Auntie Gladys. She was not our auntie, and she was not named Gladys. She was named Tess, and she lived next door. She had come in response to a panicked summons from Uncle Art, who had no idea how to cope with the sudden arrival of two pale, traumatized children from London. Tess very soon had matters under control. She bathed Peter's head with hot water. At my request, she looked into his ears and determined that my screaming had not burst his eardrums.
"Oh, you're a daft one," she said to me. "What's the good of screeching like that? Crying just makes things worse."
I had never found that to be the case. Crying usually heralded the arrival of my mother, with comforting words, cups of tea and sweeties. Of course, that was before the war, before my mother had now changed into someone who would leave me with a stranger and tell me that Father Christmas was not coming. When first aid had been rendered, Tess announced that it was time for bed and conducted me upstairs to a small room under the eaves. It was not the cosy room that my mother had predicted, but it had a bed, and better than a bed, it had a floral chamber pot.
"For the night," Tess said as she helped me into my nightie.
She opened the curtains and looked out. "Full moon tonight," she said softly. "Poor old London." I was a spoiled brat of a child, but even I knew what she meant. Maybe I understood it better than she did. Moonlit nights were best for bombers. With blackout curtains closed and street lamps turned off, London was not an easy target, and Luftwaffe pilots approaching from the east could lose their way and drop their bombs into the sea or onto a lone farmstead. When the moon was full, the Thames shone like a silver ribbon, and London was a sitting duck. My mother was in London.
After Tess departed, the stairs creaking in protest as she lumbered down to the kitchen, I climbed out of bed and knelt on the splintered wooden floor. God bless Mummy. God bless Daddy. After a brief internal battle, I asked God to also bless Peter. Christmas Eve. When I went downstairs in the morning, I found Peter already in the kitchen eating toast. As I entered the room, he actually smiled. I think we were each relieved to find that the other had survived the night, because we had come from a place where surviving the night was not a given. Peter pushed a plate of toast toward me. It's real butter, he said, and there's jam. I looked at the jam jar, which contained a dark, mysterious fruit. Blackberries, Peter said. The fat woman picked them herself. Her name is Tess, I said. Oh. About Father Christmas, Peter said. I shook my head. You don't have to tell me. I already know. But if you want to believe... I started to spread jam on my toast. I didn't want to look at him as I fought my own internal battle. Of course I wanted to believe. Who wouldn't want to believe that an old man in a red suit flew around the world on Christmas Eve and dropped presents down chimneys? It even made sense that he would not be able to fly this year because, of course, the Luftwaffe. No, it didn't make sense. It made no sense at all. If he was so magical that he could drop presents into African houses that didn't have chimneys, and he could fly so fast that he could circle the globe in a single night, he wouldn't be afraid of the Luftwaffe. What made sense, what was perfectly obvious if I thought about it, was the fact that my mother had forgotten about Christmas. In the rush to get us out of London and into a safe place, she had simply forgotten to buy Christmas presents. He's not a pirate, Peter said. I looked up from my plate. But he has a parrot and a spyglass and... He's a smuggler, Peter said. They're all smugglers. How do you know? It makes more sense. If you go to the end of the garden and look down, there's a little cove and there's a cave and there was a boat pulled up on the beach. A big one, I asked, like in Treasure Island? He shook his head and began to look annoyed. No, I told you, they're not pirates. Well, yesterday you said they were. And now I'm saying they're not. The collapse of our fragile entente was prevented by the fluttering arrival of Uncle Art's parrot and my resulting rush to drive it away from Peter's head. As the parrot flapped away in a flurry of green feathers and angry squawks, Penny the dog trotted in, followed by Uncle Art and Tess. It was only when Tess had removed her large body from the doorway that I realized she was not alone. Apparently the denizens of Uncle Art's pub were lined up behind her, and now they filed into the room and stood in silent wonderment to examine us. Their faces were hard to read. I was only 7, and I had very little experience of reading faces. I knew when my mother was lost for words. I knew when Peter was about to pull my hair. I knew when our father had run out of patience and was going to send us both to bed without supper. However, I knew very little about really old men whose faces were warped by age, rough weather, and a lack of teeth. This description fitted every one of the men who stood in a row to examine us. The fact that one of them wore an eye patch gave weight to my continuing pirate theory. Another one had an empty coat sleeve held against his chest with a safety pin, and his presence neither added to nor subtracted from the pirate theory. They mostly had stooped shoulders and crooked arthritic hands. Some were tall, some were short, none of them were fat. They all carried with them a faint odour of apples. It was only later in life that I realised that what I smelled was the famously alcoholic cider brewed in that part of Dorset. The men who stood in Uncle Art's kitchen were not beer drinkers, they were cider makers. I examined each one of them, and the lack of additional parrots and wooden legs spoke in favour of Peter's new smuggler theory. After they had filed out, Tess started to clean up the kitchen. She suggested that I should take Penny for a walk, or rather that Penny should take me for a walk. "She'll walk you down to the beach, if and that's where you want to go," Tess offered. I looked around the kitchen. Does she have a lead? Whatever for? She won't let you get lost. You don't need no lead. In my limited experience, dogs were to be walked on a lead unless they were police dogs who could be trusted to do what they were told. Tess was making a radically alternative suggestion that I was the one who needed to be kept on the lead. Peter and I followed Penny out of the back door, through the garden, and out onto the street. Well, in London it would not be called a street, as it was not paved. Of course, the main difference between this street and any street in London was the fact that it was bounded by thatched cottages. They were all in various stages of disrepair, but none of them had been bombed. Their windows were not shattered, their roofs were intact, and their walls had not been split open to reveal the rooms within. It made a refreshing change. The breeze was warm and gentle, and carried on it the sound of crashing waves and the scent of the sea. It was not the salt water scent of the Thames at high tide, when the sea mingled with coal smoke, mud, and putrefying fish. This sea scent was sweet and pure. This was the sea breeze that had weathered the faces of the old men who had studied us in Uncle Art's kitchen. This wind, perhaps, had blown in from whatever tropical island had given birth to Uncle Art's parrot. I wondered if the bird ever thought about flying home again. No doubt it was a very long way. Peter tapped me on the shoulder. Come on, I'll show you the cove. Penny bounded ahead of us, stirring rabbits from the bushes in the long grass. No, I thought, not rabbits, furry things. I vowed not to even think of the word rabbit, lest I cause them to arrive in force and collapse the cave that ran under Uncle Art's cottage. We spent the rest of that short winter day exploring the headland and the beach with Penny as our constant companion. I had never ever had such a day when nothing was required of me except to look and learn. We picked up sea glass and multicoloured beach stones. We gathered long strands of rackweed and ran as fast as we could, creating a breeze to turn them into wind-tossed streamers. Penny deposited gifts of driftwood at our feet and waited open-mouthed for us to hurl them for her to chase. We were not alone on the beach. Every now and then we would catch a movement among the rocks or along the headland. The old men were out and about, gathered in groups or in pairs, always watching us. Their boat had been hauled up on the beach well above the high tide mark. Peter was right in saying that it was not a pirate ship. It wasn't even a ship. It was just an old rowing boat. I still wasn't buying his smuggler theory. Smugglers would need a far bigger craft. It was nothing. Or was it? Peter, I said, as I sat with my bare feet dangling in a rock pool, I have an idea. He dropped a rock into the pool and scattered the tiny creatures I had been trying to attract by wiggling my toes. I decided not to be angry with him. What's your idea? He asked. If they're not pirates, they're not. And they're not smugglers. They could be. No, they couldn't. Their boat is too small. All right, then, what's your idea? Suppose they're spies. He laughed. What would they be spying on? There's nothing here. Ah, oh. I waited for him to tell me my idea was silly and babyish, but he said nothing for quite some time. I accepted that saying nothing was preferable to telling me I was stupid, and I set about wiggling my toes again to attract sea creatures. They could be home guard, Peter said. You know, watching out for submarines. I stared up at him in alarm. Here? Could there be submarines here? Maybe. They're everywhere, aren't they? For a few short hours, I had actually felt safe. We were far from London, in a place that Hitler would not want to bomb. It had not occurred to me that leaving London had placed us closer to the sea, where Hitler had U-boats. I stared at the horizon in a desperate search for a periscope or a conning tower. Peter was not looking out to sea. He was looking back at the village. They're up to something, he said. Those men have been moving about all afternoon carrying things backwards and forwards. They're plotting something. Before either of us could come to a conclusion as to what the old seafarers might be plotting, Penny pricked up her ears, ran away, stood still for a moment, and then dashed back to us, and started chivying us back along the beach. I think we're supposed to go home, Peter said. I thought of arguing with him about the use of the word home. That old cottage was not our home, but it was all we had at the moment.
We trudged together along the shingle beach, and I considered the fact that we had gone a whole day without arguing. I also considered that a day without arguing was quite a pleasant thing. We arrived back at the cottage as the sun was just dipping below the skeletal winter trees. Odours of cooking wafted from the open kitchen window, and Tessie's large shape moved back and forth, blocking the window's welcoming light. Peter looked up at the sky. It's Christmas Eve. Father Christmas won't come, I said. He'll never come again. Well, said Peter, if you look at it that way, you would have to say that he's never come before. You know it's always been Mummy and Daddy. I know now, I replied, but this year it won't even be our parents. Mummy's forgotten, that's why she's blaming it on the Luftwaffe. Peter looked into my eyes. I don't think he'd ever done that before. Are you all right? He asked. I'll have to be, I said. Wow. What? You're not crying. You've gone a whole day without crying. And you've gone a whole day without teasing, I replied. We went together into the kitchen and found the table set for supper. Uncle Art was wearing a clean shirt, and Tess was wearing, well, it was something red and festive, more on the scale of a tablecloth than a dress, but it was Christmassy. We drank cider with our furry thing pie. I'm sure the cider was alcoholic, because I began to feel quite warm and contented. Peter allowed the parrot to sit on his head and discovered that if he did not move or panic, the parrot did not draw blood. I may have fallen asleep after supper. That's another reason why I suspected the cider was alcoholic. This was nothing like Christmas at home before the war, when Mummy and Daddy would drink sherry. Peter and I would be allowed a glass of Tizer, and then we would hang our Christmas stockings by the fire. I wondered sleepily if anyone anywhere would hang their stockings. Had all the children in the world been told that Father Christmas was not coming this year? I remember waking up to the sound of gruff, masculine voices. I opened my eyes to a scene that memory has painted with a golden glow. The fire in the big old hearth was popping and crackling. Tess, in her enormous red dress, was bustling around with a tray of glasses, and all of the old men from the pub, dressed in reasonably clean shirts, were standing in a circle around the fireplace. Uncle Art cleared his throat. Well, he said, I've been racking my brains as to who you two children might be, and I still don't know, but it don't matter. It be Christmas, and you be here, and I don't go along with your mam saying there'll be no Christmas for ye. Now, when I was a lad, all I got for my Christmas was an orange, or maybe a penny lantern. Oh, get on with the art, said Tessa. No one wants to know about your Christmas. Right, said Uncle Art. And we don't have no oranges, said a voice from the back. Not this year. Tess turned on the speaker. Quiet ye down, Will. Let her speak. We wasn't ready for ye, Uncle Art said, but ye be here, and so we done something for ye. Peter and I looked at each other. I thought his eyes were slightly unfocused. Perhaps he had drunk more of the cider than I had. We don't have no shops, Uncle Art continued, but each man has brought you what he can, something he made or something he's been keeping, and Tess here has wrapped them. He looked at me. I hear tell he don't believe in Father Christmas no more, so no need for me to put out my socks. She wouldn't want to touch your sock, Tessa said. Maybe not, Uncle Arthur agreed. Well, let's get started. Will can go first, seeing as how he don't know how to keep quiet. Will, he was the man with the eye patch, stepped forward with two newspaper-wrapped packages. He placed one into my lap and one in Peter's outstretched hands. It was a bit like being the Virgin Mary in the school nativity play, except playing Mary had never given me such a warm, fuzzy feeling. I found it hard to focus on the small, string-tied package in my lap. My eyes were full of tears. I watched Peter open his gift and saw his eyes wide with wonder as he studied Will's offering. "Battle of Jutland," Will said, 1916. "That there's a 37mm fired at us by the Koenig. Biggest battleship I ever did see. It landed on the deck right in front of me. I could have been a goner, but it was a dud. I picked it up and kept it. Don't worry, it won't hurt ye."
While Peter stared in open admiration at the one-eyed old man, I looked down suspiciously at the package in my lap and wondered what grisly war memento it could contain.
"Carved it myself," Will said.
Carved it. I opened the package and found a white disc carved with the image of a spouting whale. Uncle Arthur looked over Will's shoulder.
"Oh, that's a good one," he said. "You keep that, lass. Fine bit of scrimshaw."
I continued to stare down at the little white disc. Had Will really carved this himself? How long had it taken?
"Walrus tusk," Will said, touching the gift with a gnarled finger. "When I was just a nipper, I was 7 years before the mast, down in the roaring 40s. When she ain't roaring, there's not much to do, so I done that."
The golden haze lingered. Peter acquired a pile of warlike objects, mainly German, from the war that had been fought and won before I was born. His lap was piled with spent bullets, German insignia, brass buttons, even a dagger. And my lap was filled with treasures of a very different sort. Each gift came with a story. A lace handkerchief that a long-deceased wife had carried on her wedding day. A macrame bracelet made for a sweetheart who changed her mind. A length of ribbon from a daughter's long-ago braids. Finally, Uncle Art handed me a hairpin made from bent wire and decorated with a green feather donated by his parrot. I had never had such gifts before, and I have never had such gifts since. Eventually, I gathered up my gifts and allowed Tess to lead me up the steep stairs to the little bedroom under the eaves, where I fell into a deep, maybe drunken, slumber. Christmas Day. It seemed that I had hardly fallen asleep when I was startled into wakefulness by the urgent clanging of bells. It was a sound I knew only too well. Those bells belonged to an ambulance, a fire engine, or a police car. For a moment, I thought that I was back in London, and Christmas Eve with Uncle Art had been no more than a dream. I opened my eyes. Sunlight poured in through the lattice window and landed on Uncle Art's parrot, standing guard over the pile of gifts at the foot of my bed. I hadn't been dreaming. Everything was real. So what was happening now? Had the Germans somehow found this little village and decided to bomb it? Was it all destroyed? I leaped out of bed and looked out of the window. The street outside was unchanged. The cottages were as much intact as they had been the previous day, but two police cars were parked across the street. Footsteps pounded on the stairs, and I heard my father's voice. "Ellie?" He was standing in the doorway, dressed in his familiar tweed jacket, and my mother was beside him. She appeared to have been crying. What could possibly be wrong? The police cars were no longer ringing their bells, and I could hear gruff, masculine voices downstairs.
"Are you all right?" Daddy asked.
I blinked at him. Had someone died? We were a small family. My parents were both standing in the doorway, and I could hear Peter's voice downstairs mingling with all the other voices. Everyone was safe, unless Uncle Art? Had something happened to Uncle Art?
A voice drifted up the stairs. "Daft ramshacklem," said Uncle Art. "I have a girt many brothers. How was I to know?"
"Londoners," said another masculine voice.
"Aye," said Uncle Art, "Londoners. Still, they'd be good little childers, and we did our best."
My mother held out her arms. "I'm so sorry, Ellie," she said. I brought you to the wrong village. That man's not your uncle. We don't know who he is." She stretched her arms wider, obviously expecting me to fling myself into her protection. But I couldn't do it. I didn't need to do it. From the corner of my eye, I could see the parrot sidling across the bed in the direction of the green feathered hairpin.
"Mine," I said firmly.
He focused one beady eye on me.
"Pieces of eight."
"Mine," I repeated.
I was not sure very much on that bewildering Christmas morning. I didn't know that the correct Uncle Arthur had phoned my father to ask what had happened to the children he was expecting, and I didn't know that my father had panicked and called the police. I didn't even know if we could now be taken to some other village and given to a different Uncle Art, or if we would be allowed to go home. I did, however, know one thing. The hairpin was mine, and I was going to keep it. Time has taken care of all those questions, and Uncle Art and his parrot have become mythical creatures entrenched in our family folklore. When Peter emigrated to Australia, he took with him his hoard of German mementos. He shows them to his children and grandchildren every Christmas, and he tells them the ever-expanding story of our piratical Christmas. I have my own ritual. The Scrimshaw whale is part of a necklace I wear every Christmas, along with the macrame bracelet. When I go to church on Christmas Eve, I carry the lace handkerchief. And always, as I prepare to leave the house for Christmas visits, I take out the green feather.
"Pieces of eight," says the ghost of long ago.
I pin the feather in my hair. "Mine," I say.
"Daft ramshacklem," says Uncle Art.
The end. You have been listening to The Christmas Feather by Eileen Enright Hodgetts. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved. At the height of the London Blitz, a decision was made to evacuate children from London. Their parents received the following letter. To parents of children registered for evacuation, "Dear Sir or Madam, your child has now been registered for evacuation, and the purpose of this letter is to notify you of the steps which it will be necessary for you to take before evacuation is ordered. 1. Clothing. In addition to the clothing which the child would be wearing, and such should include an overcoat or mackintosh, a complete change should be carried. The following is suggested. Girls. 1 vest or combinations. 1 pair of knickers. 1 bodice. 1 petticoat. 2 pairs of stockings, handkerchiefs, slip and blouse. Boys, 1 vest, 1 shirt with collar, 1 pair of pants, 1 pullover or jersey, 1 pair of trousers, long or short, handkerchiefs, 2 pairs of socks or stockings, cardigan. Additional for all, night attire, comb, towel, plimsolls, face cloth, toothbrush, and, if possible, boots or shoes. Gas mask. Blanket should not be taken. 2. Food. All adults and children should carry sufficient food for the day of evacuation. The following is suggested. Sandwiches, egg or cheese. Packet of nuts and seedless raisins. Dry biscuits with small packets of cheese. Barley sugar rather than chocolate. Apple, orange. Note well, liquids in bottles will not be permitted. Luggage carriers. Rucksacks are suggested as the best form of luggage carrier, as these leave the arms free. An important advantage. The rucksack may be too expensive for children. A haversack would be cheaper and would be a good substitute. You will be informed by letters if and when evacuation is ordered, and you should observe carefully the instructions contained therein with regard to the day, time and place of assembly. Yours very truly, LG Rose, Evacuation Officer.